oftentimes it's better to start with creativity to help you learn the facts.
Life is too short to learn a list of 1,000 rando words.
From the campus of Stanford University, this is Schools In with your hosts, Dan Schwartz and Denise Pope.
Welcome to Schools In. I'm Denise Pope, senior lecturer with the Graduate School of Education here at Stanford University. And I'm with my co-host, Dan Schwartz, who's dean of the Graduate School of Education. And I should say that we are actually not physically together in the studio today. Dan and I and our two guests that will be on later are actually taping from our respective homes.
Well, doctor, I'm going to push you over the edge, Pope.
Oh, that does not sound good, dude.
Well, we're talking. So let me just start with the question and you'll see why.
Okay.
So Denise, why do we give entrance exams?
Oh, yeah, this is already not good.
Yeah, I can see you flushing even now.
Why do we give entrance exams to get into universities? Is that the question?
Yes.
Yeah, why do we? Right. There's so many problems with entrance exams. They're biased, they correlate with wealth, they are not a good way to measure anything that people who are using them think that they're going to measure, right? Why? How do you decide who you should let into a class? What do you think, Dan? How should these college admissions officers decide how to let kids into a class?
Well, I'm going to have an answer for that, but I'm going to hold off because it's my punchline for how you do this.
Okay.
It's kind of the question is, if different universities want to maintain certain standards, and do we accept that premise that they have the right to admit certain kinds of students, then it seems like they should be able to do that. And an entrance exam is, the whole point is it's not fair. They're only going to let in a certain group of students.
Right. So here's the problem.
Okay.
You have thousands of students and a limited number of spots, right? So there are schools that do this thing called holistic admissions, where they say they look at everything, where it's not just a numbers cutoff of what you get on the SAT combined with your GPA. So they look at essays and they look at teacher recommendations and they look at extracurriculars. And if you talk to these admissions people, they'll say, we need all of that information because we're building a class. And we want to make sure we don't have 76 trombone players. We want to have an equal number of athletes and musicians and computer science majors and females and males and people from different states. So they see it as more than just sort of a numbers game. And yet you have places like University of Washington or UCLA where you have literally 130,000 applications. How are you going to do holistic admissions for 130,000 applications? It's like a nearly impossible task. So some schools use the SAT or the ACT or whatever to help them make those really early, tough cuts. It's because of the numbers.
Why is holistic better?
Well, what people will say, and this will come out later in the show, is that it allows you to get to know the personality of the kid, what they're interested in. When you read a teacher's recommendation, you might find out that this person is super generous and works well with others. That's the kind of person you want in your college, as opposed to sort of a jerky kid, you know? So it's
That explains where I went to college.
Oh no, Dan. But so there's lots of things they're looking for, and you can't just see that from a GPA or a test score, is what they would say.
So a holistic gives me a more true picture of the person.
Well,
and then I'm going to judge them as not worthy.
Okay. True is not a great word to use there, but yes, there's got to be a way. Look, not everyone can get in. UCLA does not have 130,000 spots in their freshman class. So they have a problem. Stanford has a problem. Little tiny liberal arts schools have problems. You only have enough beds in your dorms. So yeah, someone's not going to get in.
Okay. I just wanted to be clear on that. So okay, so let's introduce our guest, because I think I don't want to do the punchline, but in my head the punchline is there is no exam that you can give that is not going to capture years of prior preparation that is going to be largely dictated by financial and other demographic characteristics.
So that's the punchline is you can't design an exam that would be fair in this situation?
Based on certain definitions of fairness. That is correct. That all your entrance exams are going to capture 12 years of experience and privilege.
And maybe 6 months of tutoring or thousands and thousands of dollars of tutoring and practice or flashcards since you were 3 years old or fill in the blank. Or someone paying someone to take the SAT for you, which we saw in Varsity Blues.
Now I'm getting Denise whipped up.
Oh my gosh. Introduce our guests. I need support system here, Dan.
No, you're introducing. So it is my absolute pleasure to introduce Ben Domingue. He's a professor of education at the Stanford Graduate School of Education, and his research addresses student outcomes, teacher performance, educational attainment, and many, many other things. He's really deft and diverse in his interests. It's also my pleasure to introduce AJ Alvero, who is a doctoral student at Stanford, and he studies education data science, language, sociology, and race. And Denise, if you get annoyed with me, AJ took my course so he can say negative things that'll make you feel better.
Oh, good.
So welcome, Ben and AJ.
Thanks for having us.
So why do we give entrance exams?
Ben? Dan?
No, let it go. Okay, I'll let it go.
No, we're going to let that go. Ben and AJ did this amazing study, and I want to give AJ a chance to sort of walk us through what you studied and why you took this on, because I think it's really different and fascinating and exciting.
Yeah, happy to be here. Would love to talk about it. So, you know, there's a lot of startup costs that I'm not going to talk about and a lot of technical details I'm also not going to talk about. But, you know, the basic idea is that lots of universities are going test optional or test blind in college admissions, which is, you know, there's lots of different reasons to do that. So some might argue there's lots of different reasons to not do that. So, you know, our kind of theory, our hunch is that that might upweight other components of the application, like the letters of rec, like the personal statement, the college admissions essay. So we wanted to test, you know, if the SAT is not fair, quote unquote, because it has such a strong correlation with household income, what about the essays? Just simply put, we also took this as an opportunity to model the relationship between the personal statements and SAT scores, which to me is like, you know, I'll talk about it in a second. To me, that's the bigger find. So we were given access to a huge data set of college applications, not every single piece of information, but we have access to test scores, you know, an applicant's reported household income and their personal statements. So what we did, that's our data. Right. And we have information from 60,000 applications that were submitted to the University of California system. So the UC system is unique. There's one system and then, you know, you do the application for the system and then it gets submitted to whatever campuses you want to apply to, Riverside, Berkeley, et cetera. So in these 60,000 applications, we have 240,000 essays, college admissions essays. So we used computational techniques to quantify the essays. And again, you know, won't get into too many technical details there. You can see the paper. And we used the variables of associated with the quantified essays as inputs for a regression model that we then used to measure the linear relationship between an applicant's essay and their reported household income, and the reported SAT scores.
So hang on. Let me interrupt for just a second.
Yes.
When you say you quantified the essays, right, you gave them like a 5, a 4, a 3, a 2?
Yes, thank you very much. That's a very important distinction. So the way that we quantified the essays, we did not rate the essays in any way. So this wasn't us going through all 240,000 essays, you know, saying these are the best, these are the worst, and everything else is in between. The techniques we used depended solely on the words and the punctuation in the essays. So one approach is basically modeling word choice patterns across all of the essays. You know, certain students are using certain groups of words in their essays, and they're using those words more frequently than students from, you know, other backgrounds.
Words like, I was raised on a silver spoon.
Yeah.
Don't, AJ, do not answer that. In fact, I have to let folks know that we are listening to Schools In with Denise Pope and Dan Schwartz. And today we're talking with Ben Domingue and AJ Alvaro. And AJ is walking us through a really fascinating study he did where they use computers to analyze the words in student essays that applied to college.
So if I understand correctly, you're trying to find what combination of words or patterns correlate most highly with SAT, income, other variables.
Yes, in a nutshell, okay. Exactly. Right. Yeah. And again, with the premise being, you know, part of the controversy for the SAT is that, you know, it has this strong correlation with household income. So what happens when we put the essays under the same type of scrutiny? So we use computational tools to create variables based on word choice and, you know, measures of punctuation, like the number of commas that they use in the essay. And, you know, these are relatively simple approaches. There are more sophisticated methods being developed in like the computer science department here. But, you know, we wanted to keep things kind of manageable. And interpretable, relatively interpretable. So as we find out, the quantified essays do indeed have a stronger relationship with household income, which isn't too surprising when you think about it. You know, students are asked to reflect on their background and their life. You know, presumably some of those things that they're going to mention are correlated with household income. Fine, right? Controversial because it could also be controversial because, again, the relationship between SAT and income has been so controversial, and we're seeing the same thing with admissions essays. But then we wanted to measure the relationship with the essays and SAT scores, and that relationship was very, very strong, like an R squared of 50%, meaning that you can more or less explain the variance in someone's in SAT scores, or 50% of the variance in someone's SAT scores with just their essay, just the words in their essay. Another way of thinking about it that we discuss in the paper is if you give me someone's essay, we can predict the SAT score within about 120 points. And again, just the words in the essay, that's a very strong relationship. You know, we're talking like correlations of almost like basically 70%. Yeah, I think that's like, yeah, those are, yeah.
That's pretty major, AJ. I mean, that's a huge finding. And a part of me goes right to, well, have they been tutored? Have they been, you know, have their parents paid lots of money to help them write the essay? Who's actually writing the essay? How do we know that the CEO dad isn't writing the essay? You know, it doesn't surprise me that it correlates in this way with wealth. But the SAT score is interesting. Ben, do you want to step in?
So I think you're right, Denise. We have no way of knowing who wrote the essay, what kind of editing process it went through. Presumably, you know, the children of people with very high achieving parents maybe, you know, have much better editors at home than other kids. And so that's definitely part of the concern that the SAT, for all of its flaws, is something that as you noted earlier, in the Varsity Blue scandal, it was a scandal that, you know, somebody took the SAT for those kids. Having an essay written by somebody else wouldn't even be a scandal, right? There's no scrutiny on that at all. That would be a very trivially easy thing to do. So, you know, I think our perspective is that as colleges are interested in making changes to the way they do admissions, they need to be thinking carefully about how a reshuffling of the various components of the admissions package is going to lead to potentially new problems. And they also have an opportunity to really study the changes they make and ask whether these changes are yielding the results that they want.
This is Schools In with Denise Pope and Dan Schwartz. We are speaking with Ben Domingue and AJ Alvaro on why the essay is not necessarily the best approach for colleges to use. And Dan wants to know, why do we have an essay? I'll give an answer. Part of that is because your list of extracurriculars and your GPA and your test scores don't tell a fuller picture. So I think when colleges ask for essays, they ask students to tell a fuller picture of their lives. Maybe they didn't know that they had to take care of 7 siblings for the past 5 years. Maybe they didn't know that You know, they have a real interest in something that doesn't show up on their transcript, that they've done some super cool project that nobody else knows about. And part of it is to sort of check out writing. I mean, because so many people started to sort of have tutors and editing services, they added a writing component to the SAT, only to be taken away again because they thought, well, if we have them writing it in a timed environment and we know it's them that's writing it, at least we can use that as a way to look too. So the essays from the past used to also be a writing sample. People are trying to do this to make the playing field better. They're trying to get rid of the SAT because they know it was biased. They know in COVID people couldn't get to those test centers. It looks like that's going to stay for a while. What would you recommend then about use of essay?
That's a very good question. It's a very tough question. I think, you know, our study, you know, like we mentioned the limitation earlier, we don't know how these essays exactly were used. We don't know how they were scored. You know, we don't know if essay X was like the determining factor for admission for a student. We don't know those things. So I think with our study, and I think just as a baseline, we need to be thinking very critically about how we have people read these essays if we're going to include them in college admissions. So right now, for example, the University of California system hires seasonal workers, you know, high school counselors and teachers. And if that's the case, you know, I just worry about, like, you know, is the training that they're receiving more about like trying to rank essays? This is better, this is worse. Or is it really more about the goal of holistic review of, like, we want to learn something about the applicant that we can't learn anywhere else? And then kind of like, I think our paper is kind of like looking behind the shoulders a little bit and saying, like, okay, that's fine, but you need to understand that, like, the language these students are using and the types of narratives they're deploying in their essays are very strongly correlated with social class.
So Ben, a pretty complicated study, but as always, I'm sure there's a piece of data you wish you had that was not part of the data set. What is the piece of data, if you could choose anything, like how they ended up doing in college or what would it be?
Well, the even simpler answer is not how they did in college, but just whether they got into the different colleges. So we do not know about the admissions decisions made by the different California system universities. And so if we had that, that would definitely be useful in terms of the implications of the essays.
Oh, that'd be huge. Because then you could partial out how much is SAT, how much is essay. Is the thing that you're measuring in the essays actually the thing they're paying attention to? Yeah, that'd be perfect. Great.
This is Schools In with Denise Pope and Dan Schwartz. We will have more with Ben Domingue and AJ Alvaro and the college admissions conundrum, particularly about using essays, next on Sirius XM.
This is Schools In.
I'm not an expert at this. Okay. I'm more expert than you.
When you can't read in American society, you are really left out.
With Dan Schwartz and Denise Pope from the campus of Stanford University.
Welcome back to Schools In with Dan Schwartz and Denise Pope. We are having a very interesting conversation about college admissions and the use of essays with Ben Domingue and AJ Alvaro.
Okay, so I just need to get super crisp on this. What I understand is kids of wealthy families use more commas, and they also do better on the SAT. Is that's the wealth buys you commas? Is that a correct distillation of this?
Correlation is not causation, my friend.
Okay. Well, okay.
That's 101. Shame on you.
Okay. did you look at semicolons? No.
Wait, AJ, explain. AJ, explain. Help us.
So it's. I think part of it is, like, there were two things we were measuring. So on the one hand, you know, we've had the commas example that we've talked about, but it was also periods, it was other punctuation, it was use of articles and pronouns. That was one piece of the analysis that all came from one tool that we used. And that's totally, like, again, like, just one separate thing. The other thing we used is purely looking at word choice. It doesn't know what the words means. or even could mean. It doesn't know anything about the punctuation. It's purely looking at word choice. And despite like these two methods being very different, like the content of the essay, again, being modeled as word choice, and the form of the essay being modeled as grammar and punctuation and, you know, like small things in the essay, they still are very strong predictors of a student's SAT score. And they're both more correlated with household income than their SAT score.
And why this is not a good thing is...
Denise.
Me?
Yeah.
Ben?
Well, so this is where I think things get challenging. So, you know, the critique of the SAT in one sense is that it is inappropriate for it to be correlated with household income, because that effectively stacks the deck such that kids with different levels of access to resources have very different levels of access to college. Whether that is a problem, I think, is a complex conversation, but our paper at least suggests that the essays and presumably other components of the application packet would also show similar signatures of influence by wealth. And so whatever problem you had with the SAT are likely to also convey to be problems with the other features of the application packets.
Right. See, that's why I like this study, because everyone kind of thinks if we just get rid of the SAT, we're going to have a much more even playing ground. And they don't realize that there are other components used in admissions that serve as gates to let kids in or out that are heavily influenced by wealth as well. And I think that's what makes it a really powerful study.
Can I add to that, Denise? So I think you're absolutely right that these other components of the applications will also probably show the signature of class. And what is going to be challenging is, you know, what happens if we start to reload those other portions of the application. So Campbell's law is a classic law in social science that suggests that any indicator that we start to put a lot of weight on will inevitably start to be the subject of a lot of gamesmanship. And so just like kids are trying to, you know, go to test prep courses to up their SAT scores, if all of a sudden we start to care a lot about the essays, it's very easy to imagine those essays being, you know, highly gamed, right? Like you could buy an essay quite easily. And so I think that we need to just be very cautious about how these different features of the application are going to come together into admissions decisions, especially in a context wherein we might have larger numbers of students applying, as we saw this year when universities went test blind in many cases. So I think we just need to go into this with our eyes open that, you know, getting rid of the SAT may be something that schools want to do for a variety of reasons, but I don't think that in any way guarantees that they'll get the outcome they want out of that.
We are listening to Schools In with Dan Schwartz and Denise Pope, and we are talking with Ben Domingue and AJ Alvaro about the study they did looking at essays and the correlation between a student's college essay and his wealth.
So is there any assessment solution here? So like industry always wants to do assessments of prospective employees. And early on, they would do things like, why is a manhole round? Right. And they would watch people try and solve this. The answer, Denise, because I know you want to know, is that if it were square, it could turn to a certain angle and actually fall through the hole.
The lid would fall through.
Yeah. But if it's round, it can't fall through.
Okay,
no matter how
you
twist and turn. Yeah.
I think I would have never got that job if that was the question they asked me.
Well, they began to realize that wasn't actually sort of what they cared about. What they cared about was how do people deal with it when they can't solve it? So they started going that direction.
Nice.
Then somebody had the brilliant idea of, well, why don't we just give them the task we actually want them to do? Like, why don't we have them do some programming code, since that's what we're hiring them for? Turned out that was quite good. But it strikes me that's kind of the wrong assessment anyway, because what at least for college, what you want to assess is their abilities to learn from the content that the college would be offering.
Well, so assessing ability to learn is maybe above my pay grade, but I do think that a solution exists if we're brave enough to grasp it. I think colleges should start to work more on articulating the standards that they want their applicants to meet. And for the applicants that meet those standards, they should just put them into a lottery and select, you know, the amount that they can take from that pool in the lottery. I think what the problem is that in highly competitive application situations, we have schools trying to make distinctions between applicants based on just very, very ridiculous criteria. You know, how many clubs were they involved in, or other kinds of things. I think what we would be better off doing is just saying what it is we really care about, making sure kids meet those standards, and then choosing amongst those students at random, rather than trying to make highly subjective decisions amongst very small numbers.
And the reason is highly subjective decisions permit bias to slip in, as opposed to a random draw.
I think that's right. I think we would do a much better job of articulating, you know, some small set of more objective standards. Once we start to create a class in the way we currently are doing, we're just inevitably going to end up in these situations where, do you want the athlete with a certain grade point average that speaks French, or do you want the actor with a slightly stronger set of grades that speaks Italian? And who is to say? I mean, there's just no good way of making that decision.
So, Ben, you have hit on exactly what the admissions counselors want you to hit on, which is, first of all, the lottery word. You know, Barry Schwartz at Swarthmore started this idea many years ago. And the reason why everybody sort of bristles in admissions at the L word, the lottery word, is because they truly believe that they have the ability to put together a class, and that it is exactly the fact that they're looking for the football player who speaks French, or the person from Nebraska who is going to be an art history major, that makes their class unique, that makes their college great, that makes the sort of wow factor that is going to draw people to their school. So whether we believe that or not, they really believe that.
Do you think they're good at picking out who your mate should be? Like, they're really good at judging what will make a good cohort.
They find their spouse.
Yeah, yeah.
That is one reason to go to college. But honestly, what they really will say to you, and anyone at these very selective schools will admit this, is they could take everybody who is going to get rejected and put together a completely different class that would be just as awesome. I want to thank everyone for listening to Schools In with Dan Schwartz and Denise Pope. If you missed any of this episode, listen anytime on demand with the SiriusXM app and anywhere you listen to podcasts.
From the campus of Stanford University, this has been Schools In with Dan Schwartz and Denise Pope on SiriusXM Business Radio. If you missed any of it, listen on demand, online, or with the SiriusXM app.